This time on Weather Brains, looking back at Katrina 1 year later.
Well, my memory is one of absolute, complete shock.
We remember the heartbreak of a national tragedy.
That one little piece of TV clip, that is the most touching thing I think I've ever seen.
Plus, how some local news media dealt with Katrina's aftermath.
In the days after Katrina, watching the local media and what they did, they were heroes.
Also this time, following Ernesto.
You know, at one point, this thing looked like it was headed for Houston, Galveston, and now all of a sudden, you know, we're talking this thing barely skirting Miami.
And he's half man, half machine. J.B. Elliott is churning out weather information, it seems, all the time, leading us to ask, when do you sleep, J.B.?
We sometimes wonder this.
1 a.m. to 2.
Plus,
the science is profoundly not settled.
We'll have the second in our two-part series, Understanding Climate Change. That and more coming up. Welcome to Weather Brains, the podcast that is all about weather, put together by a bunch of weather geeks from the Weather Company in Birmingham, Alabama. Weather geeks like David Black, hello and thank you for joining us. Other weather geeks like James Spann, lead meteorologist with ABC 3340 Birmingham. Hello, James. What are you geeking about this time?
David, I'm geeking out over some cool lightning on one of our Skycam displays up here. I'm just sitting here like a three-year-old watching this. It's fascinating. This is a storm up in northwest Alabama at the time we're doing the podcast here, and just sitting here watching the lightning on the camera. Pretty cool stuff. It's up in Hamilton's where the camera's located.
Pretty neat. Geek J.B. Elliott with us for this show as well. Hello, Mr. Elliott. How are you?
I'm okay, sir.
Good. And Brian Peters, geeking out there as well.
Geek number three, back from a wonderful weekend, long weekend, a Thursday through Monday weekend in Mount Cheeha.
How did you like Cheeha State Park? Nice place.
Oh, it is a beautiful location. If you've never been there, you got to go. It's a wonderful place.
You've been up there a couple of times already this summer, right?
Three or four, to be exact.
Oh, wow. Is this your new retreat?
New home away from home.
They're getting to know you up there, I guess.
I want to know if Brian wore his Bermuda socks, black socks, and black dress shoes up there.
No.
No. Okay.
I haven't worn Bermuda shorts and black socks since you made note of it over two years ago.
I wish I had a camera that day.
Who's typing?
I was doing a blog update, sir.
I tell you, JB is a nonstop work machine.
I'm about to say somebody's multitasking here. I heard that thing typing away there.
You know, James, have you noticed some of the blog post times with JB? He's not a 9-to-5 guy.
Oh, this guy never sleeps. I mean, people come to me and ask me about not sleeping. He never sleeps. You know, I'll get up at I get up every morning at 4:52. You know my deal.
Mm-hmm.
And he will have already had a post on that thing for an hour and a half. You know, so
I got up at 4:30 this morning because I had to go to have my little test.
When do you sleep, JB? We sometimes wonder this.
1 a.m. to 2.
That's about like Span's schedule. That's not too far off.
I get
that's
more sleep than James. I don't think I could operate on as little sleep as James does.
See, all of us, we're only about 21 years old. This is what you look like when you never sleep.
Well, you guys, you know, kidding aside, that it's a tremendous team effort to keep that blog going. And for people who don't know what we're talking about, the weather blog at abc3340.com. James, how many people in an average weather event are contributing blog content? It's a team deal, isn't it?
Yeah, we've got about 7 bloggers on that thing. And, of course, everybody you hear in this podcast is involved in it. And all of the staff meteorologists at the television station are involved. So I guess about 7 writers in all. We've even had a few guest posts from as far away as Texas and Florida, but mostly it's 7 folks around here that put that thing together. And the traffic generated by that is just astounding. In fact, a year ago during Katrina, we surpassed way over 100,000 unique users in a matter of 2 days, and that blows my mind.
Wow.
Unbelievable. In a normal week, even when the weather's not active, we have about 30,000 unique readers. So just a tremendous viewer and reader base on there. And it's just, we really enjoy doing that. It's a great deal.
Well, and I suspect that people are enjoying seeing the blog posts that are from 1 year ago as Katrina was slamming ashore into
Louisiana. That brings back a lot of memories for folks. Some of them not so good, but it's...
I sat there. It was almost like addictive. I sat there and read those things today for over an hour, and it's got a calendar. You can go back and, you know, look at any date on the blog history, and there's some real history on that blog during the hurricane season last year, and Bill Murray, our associate who's not with us tonight, Bill was blogging from the Gulf Coast. Bill was with Brian down there in Baldwin County, and, you know, getting blog reports firsthand, and we had JB up here. It was just fascinating. And I think, Brian, why not, where Bill got all that sand in his computer and fouled it up?
Oh, yes, yes. It's a wonder he didn't sue me for getting sand in his computer.
That's what happens when you blog at the beach, I guess.
Well, what kind of memories do you guys have from 1 year ago? I know the whole country went through an emotionally gut-wrenching time, and we still are in so many ways, but what do you guys look back and think about 1 year after Katrina?
Well, my memory is one of absolute, complete shock. On Saturday night, when Bill and I arrived at Biloxi to hear the live interview with the New Orleans mayor, that he was considering an evacuation, but he had to talk to the attorneys first. That was absolutely mind-boggling to me and Bill, that he could be thinking at that at all, and that, you know, they hadn't already ordered an evacuation in the morning, Saturday morning, because Katrina came ashore Sunday night, early Monday morning. And it was like, we just were in utter disbelief that that was happening.
Yeah, Murray wrote a blog post, Brian, as I recall.
Yes.
Kind of, to me, that was one of the most riveting pieces of writing on this blog and its history, when he really called the mayor on his lack of decision to evacuate the city in this horrible tragedy that was about to happen. And I'll have to look that. I'll try and post a link to that down there sometime tonight or tomorrow. But from my end, David, I did not go. You know, our crew, we had, I guess, about six or seven people from the TV station down there, including Brian and Bill Murray. I was up here with JB working the television end. And that was a Monday landfall, and it was pretty interesting. We started off the day with network coverage from New Orleans. We thought they could do a better job of handling that, because all our people were down there in the Alabama Gulf Coast. And I think we picked up coverage about 9 o'clock and, of course, stayed with it all day into the evening hours. And, you know, for Alabama, we had a lot of trees blown down and power lines blown down, but the real scope of the thing was down south. And I think late that night, I remember watching internet feed of Channel 5 in Mobile. That's Dan Cates' station down there. Dan used to be one of our assistant news directors here. He's the news director, and they were the station that interviewed the gentleman on coastal Mississippi who described to the reporter he was holding on to his wife, and his wife was washed out to sea in the midst of this thing. And it was the most riveting live television I think I've ever seen. And we watched it as the tape just got back in the station there. And that's when we knew this indeed is a tragedy of historic proportion.
That one little piece of TV clip of that guy you were just talking about, that is the most touching thing I think I've ever seen. And wasn't Katrina when Mike Rader pitched in and changed from sports to weather all day?
You know, that was Dennis.
It was?
Yeah, if you remember, Dennis was a Sunday storm.
Yeah.
That came in on Sunday, and Rader came in and worked the Sunday morning anchor desk shift on Hurricane Dennis. So Rader made his news debut for that storm. Being on a weekday, I think we had the regular crew in for Katrina. And really, I don't think, for us, the drama was as great as with Ivan. With Hurricane Ivan in 2004, we had two of our men stranded in a stairwell of a condominium during the thing, Bill Castle and Christopher Sine. It was some real backstage drama for that, so at least we knew that the crew members were safe and sound. And Brian, as I recall, you guys were at that Winn-Dixie parking lot for this one, weren't you?
We were for Ivan, and except when the light standards in the parking lot began to crash to the ground, we moved over to the City Hall. That seemed to be the smartest thing for us to do, especially when you had a 7-ton satellite truck began rocking back and forth. We thought that was a good time to find shelter in the municipal complex.
Yeah. And the other thing, David, I don't know about everybody else, but I remember some of the national network people saying for New Orleans this was no big deal, they came out unscathed, and I guess it might have seemed that way at the beginning. This was before the breach of the levee system, but they were just kind of downplaying the thing where, you know, my knee-jerk reaction, well, they obviously don't know if they go, you know, 30 miles down the road and find the Mississippi Gulf Coast, they'll find catastrophic damage. And I was a little aggravated by that, but within, what, 18 or 24 hours, they had their big story in New Orleans there, too.
Let me ask you this, James. When you look back on that time and all of the coverage, the special coverage, internet web-based coverage that you guys were enterprising from ABC 3340, was that something of a learning experience as far as how you cover something of that magnitude?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. And one of the things that we all learned is the power of the internet after, in the days after Katrina. We used it extensively. We did a primetime special the night before Katrina on that Sunday night on our digital channels and on our live stream on the internet. We felt that it didn't warrant cutting out network programming that night, so we took it to the internet and to the digital channel we have. And really, in the days after Katrina, watching the local media and what they did, they were heroes. WWL Radio, WWL Television. We watched that channel 4 feed on the internet. Of course, they really couldn't broadcast except for that, and that's how many people from New Orleans kept in touch with what was going on, was watching Channel 4 on their internet feed. And that became a lifeline. So even if your transmitter goes off the air, as long as you've got a live stream on the internet, you're still going.
What about when you guys look back at the storm, what it did, and where we are today? Any thoughts on how much better prepared, if any, we are for another Katrina-like hurricane?
Brian's our WCM. He'll answer that one.
Be honest with you, David, I'm not sure we're any more prepared today than we were for Katrina or for Ivan. I think there's still a great deal of the old adage out there, well, it's, you know, it could happen to somebody else, but I don't think it'll happen here, kind of thing.
And, or it won't happen here again.
Or it won't happen here again. And yet, look what's about to happen to Florida with, what was it, in 2004, what they had, four hurricanes, as I recall, came across the state, and now...
No, they were raked.
Ernesto is about to come across Cuba and come across the southeastern part of Florida. Been a while since a storm, well, Charlie came up that direction, but was on the west coast, but been a while since, I think, the southeast coast has had a storm coming out of the south like that, so... Kind of an interesting situation that's unfolding down there right now. Of course, Ernesto is nowhere near an Andrew or a Charlie or an Ivan or a Katrina.
You know, what's interesting about Ernesto, James, something that you have said before really comes to mind about expect the unexpected. There was a time when the computer models had Ernesto heading toward the Texas coast, another time when it was heading more toward Louisiana, and look where it appears to be heading now. So I think there is some wisdom in what you said.
You know, I have seen tropical systems bring the most brilliant meteorologists down to their knees. And I love to say, when it comes to tropical systems, expect the unexpected. And sure enough, you know, at one point, this thing looked like it was headed for Houston, Galveston. And now all of a sudden, you know, we're talking this thing barely skirting Miami and really staying east of there. And ultimately making landfall up there on the coast of the Carolinas somewhere. And that goes to show you how much we don't know about tropical systems. And, you know, a lot of these guys in our science that are out there beating their chests, claiming how great they are and they know everything, well, I think the sign of maturity in a weather forecaster is admitting how much we don't know. And I think that's one of Max Mayfield's strengths. And he's always emphasizing, you know, don't focus on the center line, uncertainty. There's not much skill and intensity forecasting, and all these things are very important to point out to people. You know, they expect perfection, where the truth is we've got a lot to learn. So you're right, David. And there's, with almost every tropical system, something strange happens with it. So with this one...
And Ernesto, certainly been one that's been very, very difficult to forecast in terms of intensity. I mean, we've already mentioned the track, but... most of the Hurricane Center forecasts had it achieving hurricane status before it got to Cuba, staying south of Cuba. And, of course, if it stayed over water, the intensification probably would have occurred. But those mountains, you never want to count out those mountains down there. I think I mentioned that in the blog post over the weekend, that that mountainous terrain can really have an impact on a storm, even if the eye is out over water.
It can really suck the energy out. But then, Brian, what if the storm got back over water and then slowed way down? Are the waters not warm enough for it to really regenerate again?
Oh, they are. They are. And once the upper-level winds became more favorable, you know, Ernesto's been a fighter ever since the beginning, because it really formed in an environment that was not very conducive, with a lot of upper-level shear over the storm. And yet it managed to maintain some tropical characteristics through all of that. But that land, you know, the land down there, and I've never been there, but I've only looked at topographic maps, but that land is pretty rugged, especially in Hispaniola. And those huge mountain peaks down there, they really can wear on a storm quite a lot. And I think that showed with this. Now, who's to say if the storm had stayed, say, 50 or 100 miles further out to sea, if it wouldn't be a different scenario than what we're dealing with right now, which is, you know, barely a tropical storm. Or it was the last time I looked, which I've been away from things this afternoon, so I'm not sure where Ernesto is situated at the moment.
JB's called it. I was reading his blog post here. He says, personal opinion, he may be a little below tropical storm strength. JB is one of the nicest humans on the planet. He, you know, he's not going to say anything to offend somebody. It's not a tropical storm. I think everybody can look at it and see that. You know, they're holding on to it, but it looks sure looks like a depression to me, JB. I think
those mountains over eastern Cuba, where Fidel Castro hid out so many years getting his revolution together, some of those elevations go above 6,500 feet.
Man, that's enough to drag a hurricane down some, isn't it?
Yeah. Amen.
You guys still think it's a? I saw some discussions about the possibility that Ernesto could slow way down when it gets up toward the Outer Banks of North Carolina and really flood out that part of the coast there. Is that still something to consider?
I think it is. I think all the way along, many of the computer models have been indicating when it begins interacting with that shortwave trough that you're not quite sure what to expect. And I think stalling out is one possibility.
Just have to wait and see. You guys mentioned one name a minute or two back, Max Mayfield. We're going to be saying adios to him later this year.
Yeah, Max is retiring. He's going to retire not until the end of the year. January, I think it's January 3rd, is his official of 2007, is his official last day. I sent him an email because he and I go back a long way. He was at the Hurricane Center when my wife and I, on our honeymoon, went to visit the Hurricane Center.
Yeah, we remember this disturbing story, don't we, James?
Oh, yeah.
And I sent Max a note congratulating him on that, and he sent me back a note and appreciated my note to him and said he's a very hard decision to make because he is very, very passionate about the nation's hurricane service and keeping it as high a quality as possible and still doing is what James was talking about, making sure people understand the limitations and all of the uncertainty that we're dealing with in terms of trying to forecast with some degree of accuracy what a future tropical system is going to do. So Max is a wonderful guy. It'll be a great loss. I hope that they can find a good replacement for him.
I don't think that's going to be an easy job to do. I was just sitting here thinking he's had to really ride the line between two very different worlds as the director of the Hurricane Center. You know, he's been a meteorologist, and his love is hurricane research, but then he's had to spend as much of his time answering to the political arena about government forecasting, and I don't suppose that's a very easy thing for him to do, or anybody to do.
No, I don't imagine it is. When we have a storm like Katrina or Ivan or Rita or any of those storms, you know, there's a very big focus on the Hurricane Center and what they're trying to do. And still, it's the field of meteorology. And James touts about the uncertainty there. And, you know, you're dealing with uncertainty, but on something that could be a killer situation. So it really is tough. And yet the spotlight is really on you, and we're talking about, you know, 10,000 candle power light really focusing down on you. Max has done a fabulous job, and he's had, you know, it's been a nice long history of directors from Neil Frank, Robert Sheets, Bob Sheets, and Max Mayfield. And so there's been some good ones. It'll be tough shoes to fill, though.
Well, we're going to have to hang on to Max's cell phone and still talk to him from time to time and check in with him. He's a fascinating person to talk with. What happens when you mix politics with science, meteorology? Well, we're seeing clear evidence of that with the debate over climate change. This week on Weather Brains, the second of our two-part series, Understanding Climate Change. We're talking with Dr. Bob Carter of James Cook University in Queensland, Australia. Now, last week in part one, Dr. Carter discussed the misperceptions many people have about climate change and the news media's role in allowing those misunderstandings to grow. Well, this week he tells us about how strong the pressure can be on scientists not to publish their findings if those findings promote what Dr. Carter calls a balanced view on global warming.
The Earth is a dynamic planet. We live on a dynamic planet. We know every day the weather changes. On the longer term, climate changes. It always has, and it always will. The fundamental misrepresentation that is being given to the public and politicians at the moment in the public debate is that somehow climate used to be stable before we started driving motor cars, and that climate is going to change in the future as though that was somehow something unnatural or undesirable. Well, it's neither. It's inevitable. Climate has always changed, and it always will. It's become a political issue. It's no longer a scientific issue, primarily. It's become a political issue.
Given your view that this has become a political issue and extending well beyond the scientific realm, what about any perceived pressures or censorship on people in the scientific community not to discuss what they view as valid scientific findings?
Well, that political pressure is certainly there. It's probably particularly strong in North America, in both Canada and the U.S. There are recorded examples of people who are so-called climate skeptics having difficulty getting their views published, or indeed even feeling threatened in their job positions. These are difficult matters to actually put on the public record, because the sorts of things that go on inside research institutions in terms of staff and management relations don't normally make it into the newspapers. So the evidence for this is sometimes anecdotal, but I have no doubt that it exists. In my own case, I have had occasions where I find it very difficult to get an article published in a newspaper or a magazine which expresses what I would call a balanced view on global warming. If the article expresses an alarmist view, then you can dial up 20 of them every day in newspapers all around the world. But if you want to discuss a balanced view, the pros and the cons, you will find it is much, much harder to get those articles published.
I notice in your biography you receive no funding from special interest groups. You don't take money from energy companies, suggesting to me perhaps you prefer to steer clear of any suggestions of bias in your research?
The reality that statement you've just made is true. That does not stop, of course, people accusing you of bias. So it's a somewhat naive belief I have that if I don't take money from energy companies, not that I've ever been offered any, then the world will view me, as it were, as a balanced science commentator. Well, I have to tell you that's not the case. And irrespective of whether you happen to have anything to do with petroleum companies or not, you will be accused of that if you give, I say again, a balanced opinion on the climate change issue. In other words, the pressure to conform on this issue, both on the general public but also on professional scientists, is stifling.
If you were going to come speak to a public group here in the States next week, Dr. Carter, people who have been inundated with news media coverage about the perils of man-made global warming, what would you tell them?
Well, I think I'd probably tell them two main things. The first is, the science is profoundly not settled, and that anybody that gets up in front of them and says the science of this is black and white, we need to move on and talk about solutions, you should cease to listen to that person. The science is profoundly uncertain, and the reason is that global climate is an incredibly complex problem which thousands of scientists have worked on for 150 years or so, and they're going to go on working on it for another 150 years. But at the moment, we do not begin to have what you might call a general theory of climate. So the first message people need to understand is the science is uncertain. The second message is that there is a tremendous amount of propaganda around that carbon dioxide produced by humans is altering the Earth's climate dangerously. Now, there is virtually no evidence for that statement. That is a statement of belief and is based largely upon unvalidated computer models of what might happen in the future. Imaginary worlds, virtual reality, if you like. The interesting thing about the ice cores and the mud cores that I spoke of earlier that geologists look at is that they show quite conclusively that through the major glacial and interglacial, that is to say cold and warm climate changes that we have had over the last few 100,000 years, and we have one of those big changes about every 100,000 years, so they're fairly regular part of Earth's climatic behavior. Now, it is very well understood indeed that as the temperature changes between a cold and a warm period, so does the amount of atmospheric carbon dioxide change. But the devil, again, is in the detail. It is the temperature that changes first, a few hundred to a couple of thousand years before the equivalent change in carbon dioxide. That is a really important message for people to understand, because moments thought and they will realize they have never heard anybody argue that lung cancer causes smoking. The correlation between cancer and smoking is quite clear, but the timing needs to be that the cause precedes the effect. And with carbon dioxide and temperature, temperature change occurs before the carbon dioxide change. So carbon dioxide cannot be the prime driver of major climatic change. None of that should be taken to say that I'm saying carbon dioxide is not a greenhouse gas. It is, and the extra greenhouse gas that's put into the atmosphere as a result of natural temperature increase then itself has a minor warming effect. But then you get back to this argument, well, how mild's mild? And the answer is, we don't know, but we have no particular reason to believe that it's dangerous. So those would be the two things I would want Americans, and indeed other citizens of the world, to understand. Firstly, the science of climate change is not settled. Secondly, it is not proven that dangerous temperature change in the future will follow from the extra carbon dioxide we're putting in the atmosphere at the moment.
I appreciate very much your taking time to talk with us and to work us into your schedule, and perhaps we'll have the opportunity to talk with you again at some point in the future.
Well, David, I'd be very happy to do that. If I can talk to you or any of your listeners again at any stage, very happy to do so.
Very well. Thank you again, and best of luck to you.
Okay, David. Cheerio, bye.
Dr. Carter continues his research on climate change, sea level change, and stratigraphy. He conducts field studies of sediments dating back 65 million years from Australia's Great Barrier Reef and New Zealand. Be pretty cool to look at sediments that are 65 million years old, huh?
I can't imagine something that old except maybe James Spann.
Great. We're just a bunch of serious people here, aren't we? Well, we appreciate Dr. Carter talking with us. So that was a very interesting introspective into climate change, and I hope it maybe opened some eyes and helped some folks
out. I love Dr. Carter's accent, and I wish I had his voice.
Absolutely. He's an accomplished scientist, I'll tell you what. It was an honor just to talk to him because we're a bunch of weather geeks, so I was surprised, but never mind. Anyway, we won't go there.
It's interesting that we've had a number of people on Weather Brains, Dr. Carter, Dr. Christie from UAH, and they're all talking along the same lines, and yet the media still says all meteorologists and researchers out there that study the weather are in agreement, and yet it's we're not.
We need to get a journalist on here so they can have, you know, I tell you, a guy that listens to this show is Dave Baird, our news anchor here. Baird is a Weather Brains fan.
Dave, so, we want you.
Oh, really?
I would love to get Baird on this program. And yeah, I know he's listening. Maybe he'll come on here and kind of give the media perspective, because it's easy to bash those guys. I'll be the first to say, and I'm guilty of it, maybe, like everybody else.
Maybe we could shame Dave into joining us.
And he could play some of his WTBC clips.
Oh, those old radio air checks. Yeah. That'd be awesome. Yeah,
we'll have to do that. All right, James, you that's your assignment. You're going to get him on here, right?
Dave is a Walter Cronkite of local television.
I'll work on getting Mr. Baird on here with us. Maybe he can walk over. I'm in the studio, and I'm doing this show here, so all he's got to do is walk over from the newsroom, and I'll get him a mic in here, so we'll see if we can make that happen soon.
That should work. Let's check our listener email box. JB, you've got something that came in.
Yeah, I got an interesting email this afternoon from Nathan Jones. He's one of the ABC 3340 weather watchers down at Helena and Brian's neighbor. I believe Nathan also helps out a lot with the ham radio operations at the Weather Service during severe weather, at least he used to. And he said this: I have often noticed when a meteorologist makes a forecast, most of the time they say it will instead of we think, or it should, or it's forecast to. I've often wondered about this. I see it all the time with TV, NWS, and other sources. I was just wondering why this is the case. To me, it seems set in concrete that when terminology is used, this is Nathan talking, of course, we both know nothing is set in concrete when it comes to weather. Not bashing, but just curious why this seems to be the norm in weather forecasting. And I told him that I personally prefer to use it should, and occasionally we think, but sometimes I also say it will. I think if we were to say we think all the time, that it would convey to the public that we're definitely uncertain all the time.
Yeah, but I'm going to throw in an opinion here, and you guys tell me what you think of this. I think television news consultants have some say in that. They don't want a lot of on-air people saying they think. They want it to be a lot more definitive, even though the science of forecasting doesn't always back that up.
I remember those days. I remember some consultant told me a long time ago, every time I did a forecast, I had to call it my forecast. And I said, well, that sounds arrogant, but that was just their mandate. And I do think that probably had something to do with it a long time ago. But I can see Nathan's point. But I will say this. I've had some nasty mail from people that gripe that we talk about computer models too much. And we say computer model this, computer model that. And if they're correct, then the weather will do this. They just want us to say what the weather will be without dealing with uncertainty. So I agree with JB. I think if we said think, or that stirs up hornet's nest too.
In the Weather Service, they often, in fact, they always wanted us to use as few words as possible and concise words as possible to convey the forecast, because DJs on the radio, if you issue too wordy of a forecast, they will simply ad-lib it and skip over it.
Which makes me wonder, with the computer-worded forecasts that are generated by the National Weather Service now, I wonder how some of these people that are on air are interpreting those forecasts when they get rather wordy.
Well, I don't want to open a can of worms here, but it was just a day or two back I saw a forecast for one of the central Alabama counties that started off partly cloudy in the morning, becoming partly sunny. Maybe we don't need to go there.
Oh, that's my favorite. That's my soapbox.
It was there.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for the email, Nathan. And if you would like to contact us, our address is question@weatherbrains.com. If you'd like to leave a voicemail on our voicemail line, our number is 206-339-5482. 206-339-5482. For James Spann, Brian Peters, and J.B. Elliott, I'm David Black. Thank you for listening. We hope you will join us again for the next edition of Weather Brains. Weather Brains is copyright 2006. All rights reserved. Adios. Thank you guys for the assistance.
Cheers.
That was fun. Thank you guys. Bye-bye.
Right. You did a great job, David.
Just send more money, will you?